Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
There's sort of two sides to this program.
Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Robert Bonney.
One is agricultural land easements, farmlands or ranch lands that are impacted by suburban development, or maybe there are threats to turn it into non-agricultural use or non-grasslands in the case of grasslands. And so in those cases, we're providing funding to keep those lands in agriculture, to provide an incentive for those lands to they'll stay in agriculture forever. And then there's a second program under this, which focuses on wetlands and wetland habitats. And so these are either grasslands or a lot of times forest lands. We're restoring the wetland features on those. They can continue to be working farms and ranches and forest lands. But we're doing things that's going to protect those wetlands, protect water quality, protect habitat, and then importantly, keep those lands in private ownership.
This is Agriculture Today.
We are here at the conclusion of the American Coalition for Ethanol's annual fly-in in Washington, D.C. I'm with CEO Brian Jennings. Brian, how do you think it went?
I think it went well, Cindy. This was not our biggest fly-in in terms of participants, but so many time-sensitive issues. And you certainly saw the passion and the commitment and the dedication from the people that were here from around the country to help us push on those priority issues. And so I'm really pleased with it.
Well, we did have some, you know, missing lawmakers here, but it was great to see Deb Fischer take time out yesterday to come and speak with you, right?
Yeah, Senator Fischer of Nebraska, the lead sponsor on probably the most important piece of legislation for our industry right now pending in Congress, and that's the National Retailer and Consumer Fuel Choice Act, would permanently allow E15 nationwide. Of course, we're happy about having 8 states with E15, but not so happy that we have to wait until 2025 for that. And we really ultimately need Senator Fischer's legislation to get over the finish line. And so the fact that we could meet with the primary author, she could help explain to us the roadblocks that she sees in the path of her legislation, and then we could have our members go to Capitol Hill and try to help sort of remove or overcome those roadblocks. That's what this event is all about.
Well, we are 2 weeks now past March 1st, and we were still supposed to get those GREET model changes 2 weeks ago. It's supposed to be weeks, not months. What have you heard while you've been here that gives you encouragement that's going to happen?
Yeah, we don't have a real solid idea of timing. You know, yesterday, as you know, Rod Snyder of EPA reiterated weeks, not months. We're going down to USDA to do some further meetings, and maybe we'll learn more on that front later today. But here's what I'm going to do until I have a reason not to. I'm going to take Secretary Vilsack for his word that they do want to get the details right. It is true that the GREET model is complex. We do our darndest to try to simplify this when we talk to members of Congress, but this is a complex model, and life cycle greenhouse gas emissions is a complex topic. And so you introduce climate smart agriculture and what sort of value certain practices should get in the GREET model. This gets difficult, and we need it to be done right. So we're going to keep pressing on them, yes, to get the guidance out, because if you're potentially producing sustainable aviation fuel, that tax credit expires at the end of this year, and then it sort of becomes part of a new tax credit. But yeah, folks that are really seriously looking at this, this is troublesome for them when they don't know whether they could qualify for a tax credit.
We have a presidential election this year. Is anything going to get done this year, do you think?
It's funny. We heard from some of our teams that went up to Capitol Hill yesterday that the opinion was probably not much is going to get done. And that's often true in an election year. And, you know, you've got tight control in the House and the Senate as well. So, you know, Republicans on the House side, Democrats on the Senate side. So it wouldn't shock me. But, you know, there was also some feedback that maybe in a lame duck we could move something like an E15 bill. And I think that's probably what this ultimately boils down to, is building momentum for the legislation that we really would like to see, and then letting the chips fall where they may relative to November. I think things could look very different out here, frankly, you know, after the election, in terms of what Congress and the White House look like, but some opportunities to maybe move something after the election.
Here at the ACDC fly-in, I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Of course, corn market's such an important element for the United States, really, between corn and soybeans. And wheat also important, but suffering more right now due to world dynamics.
Dr. Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain economist, along with Dr. Guy Allen, senior economist at the IGP Institute.
On the corn side, really, as we were talking before we came on air, between us, really no changes in the U.S. domestic balance sheet from the February report to the March report, except a small lowering of the U.S. corn price projected for this marketing year. Again, the one that started last September 1st, going to end up here August 31st of 2024, dropped to 475. Interesting that we're at that mode now where we've come through about 2 or 3 months of very docile U.S. domestic markets, not a lot of change. And so here we have a supply-demand balance sheet on the usage side, no changes at all. When you do look back over the last 3 years, say from the 2021-22 marketing year to the one we're in, the 23-24, ethanol usage was 5.32 2 years ago, 5.17 last year, 5.375 this year. So arguably, one sector that's holding up pretty well for corn usage in the U.S. is on ethanol side. Of course, that's helped by lower corn prices. And would add in on the feed residual usage was 5.67 2 years ago, dropped last year on a little bit lower production down to 5.5, back up projected 5.6, 5.7, not a lot of change there. The export side, which is kind of the lead in on the international side, Guy, if you want to take it from there, on U.S. exports, 2 years ago, $2.472 billion, dropped last year. Again, the exports were the residual claimant after we covered the domestic basis for crush and feed use and wet corn milling, dropped to 1.6, 1.7, projected back up to 2.1. And there's a number of things happening internationally with competitors that all play into that change. Guy, what do you think?
Yep. Yeah, look, the corn export situation for the U.S. continues to be a bit disappointing. And even though we had non-U.S. corn output drop by 2.3 million tons this past month, adjustments to our competitors' exports, Brazil really no change, but they're quite strong competing on that as their season extends. South Africa lowered their exports 500,000 tons. Ukraine shipments were raised 1.5 million tons to 24.5. So it's Argentina was up 1 to 25 million metric tons. So we're going to continue to see fairly strong competition on that side. Doesn't necessarily bode well for the U.S. Corn exports. Also, on top of that, we've seen imports from the EU down 1 million tons to 22. One bright spot in the U.S. situation is Mexico imports are up 1 million tons to 20.6. which should be approaching a record import for Mexico corn. Southeast Asia was up slightly to 18.2 million metric tons. South Korea, though, was lowered, and it's standing at 1.6 million tons. China imports estimates remain unchanged at 23 million metric tons. They should again be the biggest importer of U.S. corn this coming year, of corn in total.
Adding on that, the pathway of what's been happening over in the Black Sea area.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, you can't have a farm bill without the resources. It's just a piece of paper.
Chairman of the House Budget Committee from Texas, Representative Jody Arrington.
You can map out the investment needed in the infrastructure for rural communities, and you can draw up just the right safety net to stabilize the ag economy and price risk and weather risk with crop insurance. You can have just the perfect farm bill, but if you don't have the resources, it doesn't work. And in fact, I don't think it's working now because of a lack of resources. We spend too much money. We're deep, deep in debt, $31 trillion. We have the highest debt load we've ever carried as a country, over 120% debt to GDP. The last time we had that level of indebtedness was just after World War II, but that was a world war. We were fighting in two parts of the world. Today, we have relative peace and relative prosperity, and things are just going to get worse when you look at the projections. We actually have a gap of $1.5 trillion in our budget and the funding of the people's government. And that $1.5 trillion, called a deficit, an annual deficit, will be $3 trillion in 10 years. The interest alone, just the interest on the debt, Tony, is over $0.5 trillion today. It'll be $1.5 trillion annually in 10 years. And probably in 2 years, we'll spend more to service the debt than we spend on all of national defense, homeland security, and veterans. Now, that is a problem, and that is a debt crisis that looms over our country. So it's about prioritization, right? We're doing too many things. The federal government was never intended to do this much. We were supposed to focus on a few things and do them well. Food security would be one. But our debt is crowding out investment in defense. We're at decades low if you look at spending on the military per capita or per GDP. But the Farm Bill is another example. You know, if you can't feed your own people, you're not going to be a secure nation, and you're certainly not going to be the leader of the free world for very long. And so you've got to get the Farm Bill and our food supply infrastructure right. The safety net doesn't work today because of the input cost. It's because of inflation. We've had drought. We have supply chain problems that are post-COVID that are still not functioning the way they should. But the real issue is input costs have just run away from our producers. So their margin is thin to negative, and the safety net can't kick in even if prices were good, even if they're decent prices. The margin's horrible. So we've got to fix that, and that's going to require resources. That's where my position, being a West Texan and as the budget chair for the United States House of Representatives, I get to work with G.T. Thompson, our ag chairman, as I met with him a few days ago and said, hey, let's work on figuring out how we can save some money in the Farm Bill on reforms to food stamps, also known as supplemental nutrition, save some money on program integrity in farm programs, by the way. There's waste, fraud, and abuse in those. And let's quit doing this ad hoc disaster spending, which is about 80% of our spend over the last 5 years. We needed it. But, Tony, we can't have unbudgeted ad hoc disaster spending. We need to have structural changes, structural enhancements, and the resources to make that safety net work, or we're going to have a lot of farmers out of business, and we're going to have less security and stability in the ag economy.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm here at the Ace Fly-In, and I'm with Bill Kauser, my friend from Iowa, who's a cattle producer and an ethanol plant investor, and also a member of the EPA Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Advisory Committee, and something he's been on before and been on for a while. So, Bill, tell us about that committee and your involvement in it.
Yeah, they reenacted it about 6 years ago, and they put out to the United States, they wanted people to put in their application and kind of a broad base across the country of livestock producers and different academia. And out of 560 applications, I was very blessed to be one of the 30 to become on and be able to represent the farming community, the ethanol community, agriculture, basically. And what our job is to do is we basically get three or four challenges every year from the administrator. And our job is to come together with a white paper. Is how can EPA improve their methods of reaching out to rural America, to the cities of America, whether it's wastewater, whether it's manure issues, whether it's methane, and how do we make sure that the administration hears from grassroots?
Well, you've worked with several different EPA administrators. What do you think about our current administrator?
Well, as I stated in the meeting here, we had the privilege of hosting Regan and Vilsack the first week on the job here 3.5 years ago in our shop. And like I stated, it's the first time I've seen in my career of 30 or 40 years coming in here of those two gentlemen from different offices in the same room at the same time, because we would always get their staff. And to see the relationship now that EPA and USDA have and can sit down together, not their staff, but the two leaders, and come to an agreement where everybody can work through some of the issues and policies that we've got going on. And then to be part of the farming community or the agriculture community and bring a recommendation to both of those gentlemen, because, you know, I know them both personally. It means something, and they've always got someone they can call.
Well, you also spend a lot of time here up in D.C. You're here for the ASDC fly-in. You're here almost every year, as far as I know. And you also come up here with other groups. So just tell me about your experience this year and some of the meetings that you had and how they went.
Well, you know, I can honestly say I've been doing this for 30 years. And in the last 10 years, we finally have a seat at the table. You know, as a livestock producer, when I put on my cattle cap, you know, the EPA was a bad word. I mean, we would never let them in. And another gentleman, Dave Petty from Iowa, and I decided 20 years ago we were going to change that relationship. So now we've cultivated it to where we have those positions. I have three appointments in EPA now, and we've actually held meetings in the National Cattlemen's Office with EPA, which you would have never heard of 10 years ago. So we feel very strongly that we've cultivated a relationship because they're part of our team now, and we can't forget that. Whether you're ethanol, whether you're agriculture, whatever it is, they're part of your team because it's part of the policy, it's part of the rulemaking, and as a feedlot operator, I have an NPDES permit. So I have rules and regulations I have to follow. And the reason I'm so adamant, I think I'm in here every month for the next 7 months to do something with EPA or USDA, is I want to make sure that my sons, or our sons and daughters, can farm in the future with policy they can survive with.
That's all the questions I have, Bill. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to thank agriculture for allowing us to be in here, and I want to make sure that everyone, you know, you have the opportunity too to come in here and hear your voice.
All right. Thanks very much. Bill Kauser here in Washington, D.C. with the ACE Fly-In. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Overseas, one thing that's really hurting U.S. corn exports and even domestic demand is increased in wheat feeding.
Dr. Guy Allen is the senior economist at the IGP Institute, along with Dan O'Brien, Kansas State grain economist.
Wheat values are cheap enough. They're pricing themselves quite aggressively into the feed complex. Overseas wheat feeding was up 1.6 million metric tons to 158.8 million metric tons, which is 7 million tons more than last year's number.
We don't often talk about wheat competing with corn for feeding.
Yeah, that's not a surprising but significant change. And it's as it competes with corn. But I think if you look at both wheat, soft red winter and hard red winter, it's quite cheap. And I know we're putting more of that and expected to put more of that in the first and second quarter of the wheat marketing year into feedlots in Kansas, Texas, and particularly in the West. Dan, you're probably more close to that domestically than I am.
Well, Shelby, you and I have been watching those prices, commenting on the not so much the cash bids, so they've tightened up, but the new crop bids, the last week that we looked at them, in the Garden City area, that's where the feedlots are. You know, that's where we'd be feeding it. And it got down to about 107% ratio between, basically December wheat, well, new crop wheat prices, new crop corn prices, and, some difference in timing there, but the ratio had gotten down tight enough, close to that area of about 105, 106, well, it's at 107, and, you know, if it's cheap enough on the wheat side, then people will feed it. There's some changes in rations that happen. All those real world pragmatic things have to be dealt with. But yet, if it's cheap, it is what it is. And Guy, what you said sure borne out in the last 3 years of the market, last three U.S. wheat marketing years. 2 years ago, we projected by the USDA fed 88 million bushels, 77 million bushels in 22-23, and that was in a dry year when we needed to feed something, a lot of that right out here in Kansas, and then projected this year at 120. So the lower wheat prices sure seem to be bringing that in.
Yeah, one surprising thing is that same week of the last week USDA report, we saw China cancel, it was a little over 200 million bushels of soft red winter wheat exports. And I've been trying to find out if they just canceled that or if they were buying cheaper wheat out of the Ukraine or some other origin. I haven't been able to confirm that alternative purchase in there, but that did not, that weighed on the market a bit. That said, following the USDA report, numbers coming out, wheat was actually firmed up a bit. So maybe we've seen some bottom in both the corn and the wheat complex, as both those markets have at least been steady to firmer since last week's USDA report.
The only follow-up I saw to that same bit of news was that China had also canceled French wheat purchases and some others as well. So it's not just the U.S. So it makes you, that may not be geopolitics as much as being in some contracts. They either they don't need it anymore or they want to get out of some contracts and buy something cheaper, which, you know, they're very shrewd, capable buyers, and they certainly do that upon need. So
yeah,
I know we had to wrap up. Wheat ending stocks lowest since 2015-16. So again, we're bemoaning low wheat markets, but we tightened up even further with this report. And somewhere out there, there's a time of volatility coming when the Black Sea region doesn't come through with large cheap supplies. And then where will the world go?
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I've been to the Lincoln National Forest and observed something very, very amazing there.
Arkansas Representative Bruce Westerman is a forester and chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee.
Same landscape, same climate, same forest and tree species. You've got the Muscalero Apache tribe that is textbook forest management. Beautiful forest out there. Ponderosa pine. Got your savanna understory in it, great elk hunting, just beautiful habitat. You go up the road a few miles and you're in the Lincoln National Forest, which it had one of those fires, and I don't remember how many years ago, but it's like a moonscape. The fire burned so hot that it burned the organic matter out of the soil, and they can't get trees to grow back on it. Everything the same, except you had the Forest Service managing one tract of land, you had the Muscalero Apache managing another tract. And that's why we just passed out a committee this morning a bill to do good neighbor authority, which says tribes and counties, in addition to state forest management agencies, can go in and manage timber on federal lands. They know how to do it. They're able to do it. So let's give them the authority to go in and make these good management decisions. But you can, that story I told about New Mexico, it's been replicated other times in New Mexico. You can go to California, Arizona, go to Washington State. You'll see over and over where you've got severe damage to the soil because of mismanagement of forest. And people don't always make that link between water and forestry. Now, Teddy Roosevelt called trees the lungs of the earth. They breathe in carbon dioxide. They breathe out oxygen, which they are. There's nothing we can use to clean the air, to get carbon out of the atmosphere as efficient and as effectively and as large scale and economically as a forest. Forests also are as critical to water as they are to air. You talked about these, I'll use Roosevelt's terms, a denuded landscape. You take this barren landscape, you get rain on it, you get mudslides, your topsoil, what's left of it, ends up in the streams, which decreases water quality, damages fish habitat. You know, when you do good forest management, if there's a stream, you leave something called a streamside management zone. A wildfire doesn't leave streamside management zones. It burns right to the edge of the stream. That shade over a stream helps keep water cool for certain fish species. You take that shade away, the water temperature increases. There's just so many wins to having healthy managed forest. You win with air quality, you win with water quality, you win with wildlife habitat, you win with recreation opportunities, and the list goes on. There's no downside to having a healthy forest. We just have to help our forest be healthy instead of getting in the way and making them unhealthy.
And talks about something known as biochar.
Biochar is almost pure carbon. We could take this understory in the western forest that's fueling the catastrophic wildfires, make a usable product out of it, put it on agriculture and range land, and even back on forest land, and it makes your soil more productive, holds more water, retains more nutrients, makes them available for plant uptake. and also makes your forest healthy. So there's so many natural solutions to the problems we face today. We just have to have the will in Congress to push that policy forward, to let the innovators innovate, and let this great country thrive.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Another round of investments focused on conserving and improving farmland, grassland, and wetland easements. The announcement from Agriculture Department Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Robert Bonney.
$138 million goes into our agricultural conservation easement program, and this will support about 138 individual easements across the country.
The Natural Resources Conservation Service oversees ASEP projects in two components, agricultural land easements and wetland reserve easements. The undersecretary adds more ASEP-oriented resources are expected to be allocated this year.
So what producers can do if they're interested in is, one is to go into your local NRCS office and talk to the folks there. There are also a lot of land trusts that we partner with. Sometimes it's a state land trust or a state Department of Agriculture, or it's a local land trust, a local land conservancy organization that helps landowners enroll in these programs.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.